Hi, I'm Andrew Currie, and welcome to my podcast called The Turning Point, in which we analyse the life of a known or not so well-known person with particular attention to turning points, crossroads, forks in the road that have determined their path through life. Our guest today on The Turning Point is Richard Toms. Richard is a former Australian rugby representative, a Wallaby, and he comes to us today sitting here in his wheelchair describing how he got in that position, how his life has turned through professional sport, through injuries, through all sorts of phases. And today we're starting, as usual, by asking him about his original turning point, where he was born and to whom.
Well, Mum's an Aussie and my dad's a Kiwi, and Mum decided to do a trip around the world, and she got as far as New Zealand, met Dad. came back to Australia, and then they decided to get married to Dad, went back to New Zealand, had four young boys before we moved out to Australia when I was 15 months old, and we moved to a little town called Gunnedah in sort of northwest New South Wales, and lived there until I was 10 years old. And went back there last weekend for the first time in 30 years to the Gunnedah Red Devils playing the Tamworth Pirates the other weekend. It was fantastic.
What sustained your mum and dad? What kept them busy or kept the income coming in Gunnedah or elsewhere?
So Dad was a stock buyer over in Woolworths. For Dalgetty's in New Zealand. And he, they moved him over to Australia to start buying from here in Gunnedah, out of Gunnedah. Sheep and cattle.
Yep.
And then he ended up working for Woolworths and worked for them for the next sort of, most part of 40 years, buying sheep and cattle for Woolworths.
Fantastic. Some parents set an example for their kids, but never really tell them what to do.
Yeah.
And other parents will say, you've got to do this and you've got to do that. And they'll give a very specific set of expectations to their children. Whereabouts would you say your parents were on that spectrum? Or maybe they were different, each of them?
No, they were reasonably strict. I mean, as strict as you can be with four boys. When we had four boys under 5 years. And I was the youngest. And I can't think of any day under the age of 10 where we didn't fight. And Mum didn't say, before Dad got home at work from work at 6:30 in the evening, after school, Mum, I can't remember a day where she didn't say, you wait till your father gets home. I'm going to tell your father. And that would be us sort of straightening up for about 5 minutes before we start fighting again, and Dad would, when Dad got home, if needs be, I don't remember too many days where we didn't get the strap.
Right.
So they were quite disciplined, but all four of us were, we always said we wouldn't have any other way. There's no strap or belt or cane or wooden stick or anything these days, but we say we wouldn't have it any other way. I remember last time I got the strap, the next time I was going to get the strap, I was over it. I ran away crying, saying, no more. And I think that's where I probably turned the corner of being maybe a disciplined kid.
What age did you learn that there were better things than being strapped?
Well, I don't know. Like, my first 10 years was in Gunnedah. And anything I did in Gunnedah, I was 10. Whether I was 5, 6, 4, 3,
yeah.
I was 10. Because anything I under that was Gunnedah, and that's how it was.
Where'd you go after Gunnedah?
We went to Port Macquarie.
Okay.
Dad bought into an abattoirs in Port Macquarie. We spent the next 6 years in Port Macquarie, year 5 to year 10. And again, we loved it. We loved Port Macquarie. It was beautiful, going from Gunnedah where we used to go out and water ski on a dam and go and help friends of our family do farming and shearing and marking of lambs and whatnot. To go to Port Macquarie to, a coastal lifestyle was certainly different. But in saying that, Dad got us working in the abattoirs very quickly. I remember walking, as a 12-year-old, having to load the trucks with hind quarters of beef and fore quarters of beef and the sheep and also with the fleece of the sheep
As a kid, you knew where food came from.
Right. We knew he had to work for it. Let's say that. We worked for it. Like, I'd be out there, midweek at 4 o'clock in the morning before school and things like this.
So city kids get chores, right? But they don't get the sort of chores. And you tell me whether you think the abattoir and the Gundadah lifestyle for kids has an effect on resilience and self-independence and that sort of thing when you grow up and get older.
I think it certainly builds your resilience. I was 12 years old doing these as very hard manual work, and I was right there beside the rouseabout at the yards doing the same work they were doing as a 12-year-old. Loading these trucks, and then I was also doing milk runs at that same time. My schooling was, I was asleep at school, but, I was earning some money. So it did teach me, did certainly teach me, to earn some money and how to do it. And it certainly toughened up my body for later on in life.
Excellent. So let's talk about, I think, one of the other things that affects people, and it sometimes it just washes over kids, but other times it's very important, where your parents decide to educate you for 6 or 12 or 10 years is potentially a big turning point for lots of people. Pardon me. So tell me about that, and because you're moving around and from town to town and that sort of stuff, so was there some stability and focus in your education or at least your schooling?
I'd have to suggest not. However, after Port Macquarie, Dad sold out of the abattoirs and went back to Stockbine for Woolworths and moved to Armidale. And that was in my year 11 and 12 year. And it was more coincidence than anything. But when we went to Armidale, they then enrolled me into the Armidale School, which is a private boys' school in Armidale. And it was chalk and cheese to Port Macquarie High. I mean, literally, in Port Macquarie High, if the surf was up, you'd lose probably 20% of your school after lunch.
Teachers included?
Teachers, they just wouldn't rock up to school. Being a coastal town, there was all sorts of nefarious products available on Friday nights and the Greg's Disco and things like this, and they were, everyone was back alley drinking and things like this. And then I went to the Armidale School, and it's a private boys' school, and you had to wear a tie and you had to wear a blazer, and I was told to shave on my first week at school. They said, how long since you shaved? I said, never have. And they said, well, you got to shave. I fell under the sort of discipline of the vice principal there. He took me under his wing, and it was a completely different schooling system, but I didn't really knuckle down and concentrate on school, but on school work. But it was certainly a different discipline which I had to follow.
But you had some discipline from all the work you'd been doing.
Yeah, no, I wasn't a bad kid. Dad, Mum, and Dad sort of drilled some discipline into us anyway, so it wasn't a shock to me at all. But it was a nice change to go there and have it more formalised, I guess, in a school system, and also to fall in under with all the boys that I went to school with then, and now knock around with them now.
Tell me about what sports you'd played up until that point. I'm guessing, but you tell me if I'm wrong, that that's the first time you started playing rugby union.
It was. Yep. So I was rugby league from Gunnedah to Port Macquarie. I had had one season in Port Macquarie under playing rugby union. It was certainly my first concentrated year of rugby union when I went to Armidale. Actually, when I did the interview for the school, we had to go through the interview process. at the end, the vice principal said, you know, have you got any questions? I said, well, yeah. I said, well, I'll be able to play league on the weekend. And he said, well, let's cross that bridge when you get here. As it turned out, the rugby was played on the weekend, so there was no, didn't even see a rugby league again. I didn't even play rugby league after that.
I'm jumping ahead of myself here, slightly out of sequence. But a lot of us play some sport. I played a bit of rugby. There was never a moment where I thought, you know what, I might be really good at this. I might end up playing for Australia. You did end up playing for Australia. Mm. I'm trying to pinpoint on the journey from being a year 11 kid at the Armidale School to being in a Wallabies squad. Somewhere along those, on that pathway somewhere, it occurred to you that was where you were heading. For some of us, well, not some of us, some people it happens very early.
Yeah,
sure. Some people that doesn't happen until they get picked and they think, what am I doing here? Where was it for you on that continuum?
I'd never really, I'd watched Kangaroos. I'd probably watched some of the Wallabies going around. But in 84, when I went to the Armidale School, my first year in year 11, between the 84-85 year, so I started in the start of 84, during that year they were fundraising and preparing to go on an overseas trip to follow the 84 Wallabies. I joined that year, and I wasn't a part of that tour until sort of the season got going, and I think they realised that I could play, and then they said, well, you know, do you want to come on tour? And Dad obviously wanted me to go on tour, and so I jumped in there and started fundraising and doing all the parts of the, you know, the parts of getting the funds together for the tour. And then when I went over there with the Armidale School and we watched the Wallabies matches, that was probably when I first thought, oh, this is all right. They go all right. And then on the last match of the tour, they were playing against the Barbarians, and the Wallabies had a fantastic game, and David Campese tore them apart. And I knew the doctor of the Wallabies because he was part of my New South Wales schoolboys side that year. Anyway, I went down to him and I got a message to him that one of my teammates needed a few stitches out of his eye, and he got us into the change room. Myself and my mate and another guy, we got into the change room with the Wallabies after their Barbarians match. My mate, whilst he's getting his eye sort of tended to, myself and the other guy were sort of wandering around the change room, like in awe of these guys. And then when it came time to leave the change room, we sort of walked out in amongst some of the players, and we were dressed in blazers. They were dressed in blazers, the Wallabies were. And I had a pad shoved under my nose saying, will you sign this? Sign this. So I took advantage of that and thought I signed my first autograph. And there was, you know, it was Michael Liner, one side, Simon Poitvin, Mark Eller, and right across the middle with Richard Toms. I'm sure that punter is wondering who the hell was that bloke. He wasn't on tour. But that was my first autograph, and that was probably my first thing. And this is pretty good, you know, what they get up to, and you know, the touring and this adulation which they were getting. I thought that's a good time to start pitching for the Wallabies.
Sometimes blokes in sport, women in sport, have mentors outside the family, and they're sort of like uncle or auntie type figures, an extra parent or an extra leader. I know you had one. I know that person was taken from you. Can you tell us a bit about that story?
Mm. So when I went to Armidale, I'd only played 1 year of rugby union, and the coaching wasn't flash. It was just, you know, get out there and have a go at rugby, but without any real technical coaching. So when I went to Armidale, my coach was Ken McConville, and he basically taught me the basics of rugby, and it worked, really worked. We went through a good season 84, and then ended up going through undefeated in 85. But in between, after that tour with the Armidale School to the UK, we came back and we're into the summer period, and I was out getting ready to play cricket for the first 11. And then I was told, come over and told by one of the masters that that Ken had been killed in an abseiling accident for the school, and his son was the one, he was caught on the rope halfway down the abseiling, and he went down the rope, another rope to help release him, and unfortunately the rope wasn't tied properly, and he fell to his death, and he was a mentor to all our squad of that tour, and Amalgam sort of brought our team so much closer together, and we went through the 85 season undefeated. We beat half a dozen of the GPS Sydney schools, including St Joseph's, which our school hadn't beaten in 79 years. We'd beaten six of the Brisbane GPS schools, and I don't think Taz will ever go through undefeated again. And now they play in GPS thirds instead of playing the first time.
That could have gone either way. If that team had all been a bit upset and lost focus and lost, no one would have judged you guys for having a really bad season, having lost your coach like that.
Yeah.
So what happened? Why did it go so well in that sense, and what did you learn from that?
So John Hitwell he took over as coach.
And
John
he was Hitwell, a former Wallaby halfback.
He was a fantastic, but not a great coach, but a good man manager and whatnot. But as a squad, we all of us had been on that tour. We all come under Ken's influence. We all knew our game pretty well. I'd been made captain that year, and basically whenever we took the pitch, in lead up to the match, just before run on, I always said, guys, we got 16 of us out here today. 16 of us, let's play like 16. And so Kenny was always in the team. His son was my vice captain, and we're just a very tight group. And even now to this day, that 84-85, I got on my chat group, 84-85 Taz, we went away a month ago for down to Melbourne for the races and a long weekend of rugby down there. And we had 15 of the 30 guys that went on tour down on that. We weren't very close, probably because of that death, but also because of the success we had.
Well, they're all connected by the sound of things. That's impressive. Yep. At the end of your last school year, everybody in the whole world finishes school probably, and then has to make some sort of decision. So we're talking about turning points, and that's one of those really common ones that everybody faces. So you finish year 12, and what are the options in front of you?
So at the end of year 12, I went on the 85-86 Australian Schoolboys Tour with Ricky Stewart was our captain. David Wilson was on the tour, who has played 80-odd tests for the Wallabies, and a few others. I got accepted to go to the Northern Rivers College of Advanced Education to do human movements.
Not everybody knows what that means, because that's a... It's not a sort of super modern phrase, human movements.
No,
but what does that mean for people who haven't heard that phrase?
Basically, it's coaching and understanding the anatomy, physiology, so you can do personal training, etc., things like this. I'm not really sure what my mark was for HSC. I'm not sure if it actually got me into that college or not, or whether it was my rugby application that got me there. But I got into a college, so I thought, well, that'll do. Jump in there. Human movements sound like it up my alley. I'm interested in the sport in the human body, and actually when I got there, I was interested in it. I wasn't interested in maths or science or geography or anything like that. But when it came to human body and etc., turned out to be a good product, a good subject for me, and I've used it basically throughout my career ever since in what I've done thus far. So
that school that you went to, the Northern Rivers CAE,
yep,
you got engaged by the content, but I guess you had good teachers and you thought it was well run. Tell us about the place itself.
Well, it's Northern Rivers, it's based in Lismore. It wasn't a university, so it didn't have as stringent numbers required to get in there. But it was just a good bunch, a good cohort of, you know, knock around, not highly scholastic students, but people who actually knew sport and liked sport and liked the body, and we're all on the same page. I guess that's like any university cohort. If you're in doing a course or something, you're all studying the same thing. You get on with each other. So it was unreal, and I loved my 2 years in Lismore before I moved up to Brisbane.
Awesome. So at that point in time, we're on the way to you becoming a professional rugby player, at least a rugby player towards a professional era. Mm. But nobody had a career in rugby football in those days. It wasn't even imaginable. There was one or two blokes like Campo and Michael Liner getting money to pay wear football boots or something. I don't know where that money came from. Exactly, but that was really unusual.
Correct.
So your career focus couldn't have been rugby, but it might have still been your primary focus. You tell me.
Oh, look, I didn't really plan out a career. I just basically thought, well, if I go here, I'll get a certificate at the end of it, and then I'll see what I do with it after that. But I actually had the year off rugby the following year after first year out of school. I took the year off rugby because I had an injured leg, and they suggested I do that. I had the osteomyelitis, which if that didn't get cleared up, I would have lost my leg. So I thought I'd better take that serious, and so I did. So I had the year off rugby, and I loved it. And then I went, had the second year I played rugby, and I made the Australian under 21s, and I was about 18, 19 at that stage.
Playing out of Lismore,
yep, for Far North Coast. And then it was after that, and I finished my second year there, and then I was like, well, where do I go from here? I had a girlfriend in Lismore, so Brisbane seemed closer than Sydney. So I went to Brisbane. That's my logic. There was no path. You know, this is my path to the Wallabies, or this is my path to a career. It was like, oh, that's convenient. I'll go and follow that one, you know.
It's pretty common. Good. People don't admit it, but it is. I think it's a lot more common.
I think it is.
Like Cool Hand Luke says in the movie, I never planned anything in my life.
There you go.
And there's a man to follow. Hey, listen, tell us about, I started to touch on this before, when rugby became really important and really serious, and because you played at state level for a little while before you played for Australia. So tell us about, was there a turning point there where you thought, hang on a second, okay, I've made under 21s, I'm pretty good at this.
Oh yeah, it did. I did have a turning point really. I when I went up to Brisbane, I was basically speaking to a couple of guys I played the Australian 21s with. They were based in Brisbane, John and Paul Mulverhill. Paul Mulverhill might be a name that rings a bell with some of our particularly Northern Beaches people. So I moved up to join them at Souths in Brisbane, but I played for Queensland before I actually played for Souths. And I ended up playing all their games in Queensland in what proved to be Bob Templin's last year as coach after 20 years as coach, probably his most unsuccessful year, and that we didn't win a match. And then I got selected onto the Wallabies that year in 1988. Went away with the 88 Wallabies, and we weren't really successful either, probably winning not even half of our games on tour. So I'm thinking, at that stage, I'm thinking maybe I'm not really at the pointy end of this international rugby setup because I hadn't won too many matches. And I decided to stay over there and have a bit of a travel, you know, after the, because I'm young, I'm more interested in, you know, the rugby. It seemed to be coming pretty easy to me, so I figured, you know, I can treat that as a little side product, and I can still live my life. So I stayed over there and did a bit of travel, and then I was meant to come back early January to go on a compulsory camp for Queensland. And I flew in the day it was starting, and it was in the hinterlands of, you know, Noosa or something. And I basically put out the message, oh, I'm a bit tired, I'm a bit jet lag. I can't possibly drive up to Noosa, up to the hinterlands. And John Conley was just taken over as coach of Queensland, and that didn't go down too well with him.
I think those pre-season treks of his are pretty famous for being tough and all about attitude and discipline, right?
100%. And obviously changing the curb of an unsuccessful season the year before. So as coincidentally, when I didn't go on that camp, well, Tim Horan and Jason Little did go on that camp, he had his own little pet from his own club. So I didn't get a look in with the Queensland that year, and only played in the under-21s set-up in Queensland and the Australian side. And I thought at the end of that season, it's probably time for me to move, and that's when I moved down to Northern Suburbs Club in Sydney and started on my New South Wales career.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us about, it's unusual, you're almost in a trivia question, is the guy who went away with a World Cup squad, and tell me if I'm wrong.
I'm in that trivia question.
Yeah. I think I'm right to say that the Wallabies won the 1991. I don't know whose teeth, I've got someone's teeth in. Won the Rugby World Cup.
Yep.
You're in the squad, and yep. I think your on field time for the whole tour is roughly 0 minutes.
Roughly. If you round it up or down, it ends up at zero.
Okay. Yes. Now, I've been on rugby tours. Mm-hmm. And the players who are in the top level, especially the good guys, are always telling the blokes who aren't on the team, mate, you're part of the team. You're part of the team. You are part of the team. And they try very hard
you're
to make
it. You're not going to tell me it's different, are you?
Please don't
tell me it's different.
My question is, did you feel like you were part of the team?
No, I did. I actually did. We'd had a very successful year that year with the Waratahs. We went through undefeated, which, you know, the Waratahs don't do that too often and haven't done it since. And we were very successful, which got a lot of the Waratahs into that 91 squad. And during the selections of the 91 squad, apparently it took 10 minutes to select the 25 of the 26 players, and it took another 2 hours to select the 26th player, and that was me. And that's primarily because John Conley was one of the selectors, and he was pushing for his little he had his boy in Queensland he wanted to push for, and the rest were pushing for me, I gather. And anyway, I got through. But he was still a selector on tour. And anyway, as it turns out, on the 91 World Cup, we play three pool matches, then your quarter, semi-final and final. After the during the pool matches, to be honest, Australia wasn't clicking. We'd beat Argentina by maybe 15 or 20. We beat Samoa 9-3 in a very wet match. And then it came to play Wales, and I figured that would be my match that I'd get played, and I was overlooked. And then Bob Dwyer pulled me aside and said, look, you know, I know you'd be playing the best rugby of your career, and I would have been. I was training really well. I was doing everything probably above what I'd normally do. And anyway, he said that the other two aren't playing into form and he wants to play them into form. And I had to accept that and just see how that went. As it turned out, we went through and we won the World Cup. Tim Horan was probably player of the final and played himself really well.
And he's in your position in theory.
He was in my – exactly. He was the one I was vying for. And so, but I certainly believe I played my part. And as you say, the upper echelon players say, tell me I do. So I did. So it was worthwhile.
But it's a positive reflection on the culture that a bloke in a squad who's not getting game time can still believe that he's part of the squad, and he is, right? That says something about the culture of the sport that you and I both follow.
Yeah, without a doubt, without a doubt. Well, even in the lead-up to the final, I think Tim had a bit of a flu and was doubtful potentially for the final. It was then said that, well, if he's not fit, I will go on and play. Now, at that stage, I was playing at about 92 kilos. That was my ideal weight. But after 6 weeks of World Cup touring and not knowing I'm going to play, maybe my diet had been sort of neglected a bit and I was pushing 100 kilos. So I was dreading, actually, if I had to play in that final. I was going, come on, Tim, you've got to get well.
That's my question, right? Because on the verge of a Rugby World Cup final, part of you was thinking, my God, I could be part of this awesome team. Mm. And part of you thinking, actually, Timmy Horan's pretty good and I'm 100 kilos.
And that's right. I was thinking he's in better form than what I am. I was in good form at the start of the tour when I was thinking I was going to play. But at the end of the tour, when I'm not going to play, I'd sort of rounded off a few things, you know.
So, Richard, I'm going to talk about a turning point, which isn't just a turning point in people's lives, but for the game that you're involved with, rugby. In about 1995 or 1996, a game that had been amateur for well over 100 years became a professional sport. So tell me how that affected your engagement and involvement with that sport.
Well, it was controversial at the time. There was going to be a takeover by Louis Late from South Africa to have a rebel professional rugby competition take off. And so we went through a lot of turmoil in getting over to that changeover to professionalism, and all the home unions came on board, and we all signed up to the ARU at the time. It was 1996. I must have been, 28. So I figured the New South Wales coach at the time must have thought, well, you know, maybe he's looking to move me on or something. He allowed me to keep working, whereas the rest of the squad had to make a choice. And I was working for a medical device company at the time called Stryker. And I worked my day job, and I did the rugby, and I turned professional. So it wasn't a lot of change for me at the time. However, there was more commitment or more
expected,
more structure. You had more expectations of you from the union, which, you know, took a bit of an adjustment, and some adjusted better than others.
How did you adjust?
I was a bit old school, and I wasn't one to really conform too well, and that probably even led down to my demise maybe at New South Wales.
Well, you tried to keep the amateur spirit?
My amateur attitude more so. I still saw if you're travelling with rugby, there's more to the rugby, more to the travel side than rugby. And I always like to burn the candle, as I said, you know, and try to explore the country a bit more, be it during the day or be it at night. And so anyway, I sort of kept up with that attitude. And then my second year in with the Waratahs at that time, I was approached to play in the UK. And I saw that as an opportunity because I started to be played on the bench for the Waratahs. And so I signed up with Gloucester and headed off to Gloucester in 1997 through 2000. So I had three seasons there.
And that couldn't have happened or wouldn't have happened with you living any comfort in the old days of amateur football. You might have gone and played overseas, but you would have been expected to feed and house yourself. Talk about your family and how that sort of worked in.
Yeah, well, it was a decision to be made. Primarily because my wife Carissa was in the Australian netball team, and by 96, 97, that would have been her about a 10th year in the Australian team, looking at another World Cup, and then also looking at the Commonwealth Games in 1999. So we had that decision to make. We'd only just been married for 6 months, and I headed off overseas, and she came and did part-time, you know, 2 months here and 3 months there, back here and 2 months, etc. So that was the only real difficult decision to make. I was very willing to go over there and be a professional rugby player for 3 years, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Excellent. So I'm going to bring you to a pretty heavy topic. I'm going to ask you to tell me about your brother, who's no longer with us, and the particular career path he took and why he took it and where that led to.
Yeah. So that's my brother, Brett. He was 2-3 years older than I was, and he wasn't sure what he was going to do when he left school. He started an accountancy degree, and he lasted 3 days. And realised that wasn't for him. And then I think he went and joined the army, and with the army side of things, he wasn't one to just sit still and just sort of be rank and soldier, so to speak. So he ended up progressing to the SAS.
And that's an elite, serious unit, right?
Special Air Service. They're the elite of the elite. They're the ones that go behind the enemy lines and do the reconnaissance and are not meant to be seen and not meant to be heard of, and no one knows what their missions is. Even to this day, his wife doesn't know what his missions went on and what he actually got up to. So he was in the SAS for, 10 years, going on 10 years, before an incident happened. And it was actually on his last mission before he was going to be leaving the army. And he was doing a night mission in the Black Hawk helicopters up in Townsville, and there was two helicopters flying side by side, and there was night vision goggles in play and all sorts of activities in the back of the helicopter about them, disembarking, etc. And unfortunately, one of the pilots got his bearings wrong and flew too close to the other copper and a chopper, and they ended up colliding. And unfortunately, Brett's helicopter plummeted to the ground and killing 15 SAS soldiers and RAR air soldiers, and 18 in total. And it was obviously a tragedy for Australia. They were up there training for the Sydney Olympics, actually, for terrorism, anti-terrorism training, and all went wrong.
When that happened, presumably days, weeks and months of public inquiries, army inquiries, national attention, what was your assessment of the way that, let's just say Australia, but Australia is represented through whether politicians, army boards of inquiry, the top brass, as they call it. What did you make of all that at the time?
Look, to be honest, I was more in grieving and also looking after my parents, and my parents totally changed. They went into a bit of a skeleton of what they were previously, and for a good decade, they, particularly Mum, I really, really battled. So it was all about sort of helping them through the trauma and through the grief.
It changed your role in the family, right?
It changed all our roles. It got us closer together, certainly, and made me more certainly conscious of Mum and Dad, and also Brett had a wife and two children, who were a boy 5 and a daughter 3, they were living in Perth at the time, and they had to make an adjustment. So we all had to adjust a hell of a lot. I was actually told of the accident, now I think about it, after an Australia A versus England A match, which I'd played very well. I'd actually been sent off with 10 seconds to go for a ridiculous decision. I've spoken to the referee since. He says the same thing. And we're out. I was out with my brother that night celebrating, and we were told at a nightclub of Brett's the accident and what had happened. And we're up the next morning and flying off to Perth to go over, obviously, to see the sister-in-law, etc.
And how are you with those kids that were 5 and 3 now, all of a sudden uncles? family generally, but uncles and grown-up males might have become more important. What's your relationship like with those kids now and compared to how it might have been otherwise?
Yeah, it's totally. I'm sure it's different to what it could have been, what it would have been. Now they've basically got three fathers, myself and my two brothers. We're in touch with them quite often. I ended up going with a group of mates to walk Kokoda, and they came and walked it with me. And it was a very much a cleansing period for both of them, particularly the daughter, Jivani. They realised a hell of a lot and got a lot out of that trek, doing Kokoda, understanding what happened in Kokoda, and relaying it back to what my brother Brett may have done.
So that gave them an insight into the Australian military psyche.
Yeah.
Not just a walking adventure, which would be great in its own right, but that had context for your brother's choice of life and career.
Yeah, yeah. It gave them a lot of context about my brother's career. They, you know, Kokoda, I honestly believe if an Australian goes over to Europe, they should go to Gallipoli, and if they're here and they're looking wanting a good trek, they should go to Kokoda and learn about our military history and what our diggers went through. And that gave me a lot of context about Brett also, and I know it gave Josh and Jiv a lot of. Actually, I think it gave them a lot of solace and a lot of relief about understanding what he got up to.
A meaning for that sort of commitment, right?
Yeah, and got a lot off their chest and off their mind and et cetera, and I think it gave them good relief.
Fantastic. Now, at this point, I'm going from challenge to challenge here. At this point, we haven't mentioned that most of your transport around the world these days is in a wheelchair.
Yes.
And people understand that rugby's a dangerous sport and that way too many, one is too many, but way too many rugby players end up in wheelchairs. But you're not in a wheelchair. First of all, you're not in a wheelchair all the time because we walked in here this morning, but you're in a wheelchair a lot of the time and your accident wasn't from rugby. Do you mind telling us what happened to you to put you in that particular position?
It's so ironic to have played the rugby that I did, and the number of I played over 300 first division type matches, and the position I was in when I got injured playing soccer was a position I was in thousands of times playing rugby.
The physical position you're in.
Yeah, yeah. The squat position, you know, as a goalie, I was down in the crouch position waiting for the ball to come into my arms. And generally I'm in that position over a ruck or a maul or something like that. And the accident's never happened in the rugby side of things. But when I was playing the soccer, I was down in that crouch position and the ball was crossed in the box. I went down the crouch position, and as the ball came into my arms, my defender, who was holding off the striker, peeled away, and then the striker was right on top of me and didn't realise. And his only option, I guess, was to try to hurdle me. And his trailing knee caught my forehead and knocked me back and onto my back in a whiplash fashion. And I knew immediately I didn't get knocked out. I immediately hit the ground, and I told him, I said, "This isn't good. Just call an ambulance. Don't move me." And that's how it was from then on.
Yeah, it's a presence of mind at the time.
I knew exactly what had happened, and I was resigned to it straight off.
A lot of people, well, I don't presume you stayed resigned to it for that phase, right? There must have been times over the next days, weeks and months where you had been furiously angry or looking for, I don't know. But within that spectrum, tell me of, we're talking about turning points. Okay, time to look forward. Now, maybe it happened to you as you hit the ground, time to look forward. For other people, it wouldn't happen maybe ever, or it might take days or weeks or months, or some incident might trigger that. Okay, time to look forward. For you, when was time to look forward?
That is the bizarre thing. It's as soon as I hit the ground, as soon as I woke up, or sort of as soon as I hit the ground and I looked up and within minutes, within a second, whatever. I tried to move. I wasn't able to. I realized pretty quickly that I think this is a spinal cord injury, and I was probably the calmest one on the pitch, really. That, you know, there was guys around me wanting to knock the head off the guy that, you know, ran into me because he was overzealous, I feel, and they felt. Even then, as I was waiting for the ambulance, I'd pretty well resigned to my situation. I'd resigned to forgive the guy that ran into me because, you know, it was never...
He couldn't have anticipated an injury like this.
Well, he was overzealous. He shouldn't have been doing what he did. But the fact that he'd knocked me into this situation by me holding resentment was never going to do anything. It's only going to make his life harder. And there was, yeah, it's no need for both of us to suffer. So I was pretty well forgiven straight away. And I didn't really have any anger really going forward. There was a few around me, a few of my family and friends that did, but I just couldn't see any use in that. It just wasn't going to achieve anything.
But you're describing a wisdom and a maturity and a level-headedness that a lot of us wouldn't have had. At the risk of making yourself assess, would you have thought yourself before that point in time as a sort of bloke who can just shoulder this stuff and move forward? Did you have that opinion of yourself, I'm the sort of person who can wear a big hit and keep looking forward and not resent things and do that very quickly? Most of us don't have that.
Might be from my rugby background, to be honest. I think you know, like me, that, you know, what goes on the pitch stays on the pitch, you know. It might be that sort of background that I have in rugby that says, well, you know, it happened on the pitch, it stays on the pitch.
Keep going.
I never ever held resentment for anyone, really. If whatever happened to me, whatever was done, there's very few people I dislike totally.
And I won't get you to name that tiny number.
There is one I can think of. Yeah. But
well, I haven't got lawyers, but if I did have lawyers, they would tell me not to get you to name that person.
There's very little that really riles me that I can hate anything.
Well, very good. You're an example to all of us. Tell me what that did to your day job at the time, because I think you were still working in that medical devices sphere.
Yeah.
And tell us about what you do now and how that's connected to your injury.
Yeah. So I was still working in the medical device industry, and I'd sort of been with the company. I was actually a commission salesperson at this stage. So I was working on my own because I didn't like the regiment of working for a company. I'd like to be able to do my own things. And I was fortunate that so it happened on the Saturday. I was meant to be at a conference for that company that night. They got wind of my incident and the CEO said, where are we at with Tomsey's contract? I said, oh, we always do it on a handshake because, you know, he's too difficult. He sells everything and we can't tie him down to any sort of products in specifically. So we do it on a handshake. He said, on Monday we go back. We backdate his contract for a month back to the 1st of July and we pay him his 12 months of his last 3 months average salary. It's like, oh, that was gold. That was lovely. It's the best thing that could have happened. You know, it took a lot of pressure off financially, particularly. And then I was the next year, I was out of action for work. I was I was about 6-7 months in seven months in hospital, and then I was home for another 4 or 5 months.
Where was hospital?
So I was Royal North Shore for 6 weeks and then Royal Rehab, which is out of Ryde, which is specifically a spinal cord injury rehabilitation complex. So I was there for 5 months. And then I came home 5 months and then I went back to work. I went back to work and I was used to management type roles. And I went back to work as a an educator, which I like educating, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. Anyway, I was there for another year or so, and then I was approached for a role with the Hearts in Rugby Union, which is a charity for the official charity of Rugby Australia, and I raise money for permanently injured rugby players, basically people who are in the same position I am, but that's happened through rugby. And so I've now been doing that for the last 6 or 8 months, and it's going quite well, and I'm really enjoying.
Apart from the fact that you're helping these guys out with resources, I presume from time to time, probably more than from time to time, you advise or mentor or talk to these people and let them know that you're part of their team as a bloke, not just as an employee at Hearts in Rugby Union.
Absolutely. I think that's probably what my strongest bow is, the strongest string to the bow is the fact that they realise that I've been through what they're going through or what they've been through themselves, and that I can communicate to them on that level, on the emotional level, as well as we can also go toe for toe about our physical conditions and et cetera and understand each other. So it's a really satisfying role in that regard. I think I'm pretty well. It's a really good role for me as well as for Hearts in Rugby Union.
I would suggest that the worst thing in rugby is the physical danger. It's also why a lot of people play. People do choose a violent sport, and they know it's a violent sport, but nobody wants to see blokes in wheelchairs. Tell me about the culture of the sport and how it's treated you and how it's treating your mates, who are your mates and your clients at the same time, about what the sport brings to those people culturally, supporting-wise, etc.
I don't think people who haven't played rugby quite understand quite what it has. A good mate of mine, Andrew Blades, who's an ex-Wallaby, he was talking about his daughter who's only just taken it up in the last 12 months. And she's played a full season, and she's sat down with him and said, "Dad, I get it now. I've been sitting around all my life," and she's 19, sat around all my life listening to you and the mates banter around and talk about your games and talk about rugby. And she says, "I get it. Now I'm playing, I just understand how you build up that bond and that unity and team culture through playing." She'd played hockey, she'd played netball, she'd played all these other team sports, but just gets it in rugby. And rugby is really unique like that. Whilst it's very similar to rugby league's still very much an individual game, and the individual has to crack the line. Whereas in rugby, you hit the line, then you got six mates up your backside, trying to get the ball through the line. So rugby is a very different culture, and I think it's shown in having a foundation called the Hearts in Rugby Union that look after these people from a lifetime basis. They've got a permanent injury, we look after them for a permanent time.
So their relationship with Hearts in Rugby Union is unending.
It's unending, absolutely. And I reflect back on my soccer, mate. I got my insurance payout, and I haven't heard from them since.
Right.
So it's a whole different culture.
What's next?
Well, I see there's a lot of avenues for making use of my position, but also making use of my other wheelies, as we called, throughout the disability sector. As I say, we're from a different culture, and I think we can sort of help develop that sort of unity within wheelies and even into the more general community. And I think that if I can sort of galvanise that within our wheelies and use that as a energy into a wider wheelies community, I think it'd be a strong message.
Thanks for your time.
Good on you. Thanks, Goros.
That was The Turning Point. I'm Andrew Currie, and thank you for listening.